there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome and thanks very much for joining me at the podcast today. I just talked with Agnieszka Joniak-Luti about her new book, The Han, China's Diverse Majority. This came out in 2015 with the University of Washington Press. Now, this book has a number of really interesting central arguments that help it contribute not just to the study of social anthropology or the study of China, but also to the study of some really important concepts that range much more broadly from these core fields outward into many, many different kinds of fields of inquiry. Those are arguments about notions of ethnicity, of identity, and much, much more. One central argument of this study also locates this social anthropology study within a broader historical frame. And in the words of the book, that is, different eras have produced different categorical understandings of the Han, as well as different Han nesses, or markers and enactments of the Han identity. So based on more than 100 semi-structured interviews in all kinds of places, what Agnieszka does is she creates a way of thinking very flexibly about not just what Han identity and Han-ness might be, but also how we might think about identity and the various ways that identity is both fragmented and coherent at the same time, more broadly speaking. So it was really a pleasure to talk with her, and I think the book is absolutely a must-read for any of us who work on anything having to do with identity and ethnicity in China, as well as well beyond. Thanks very much for listening. Thanks, as ever, for your support of the podcast, and I hope you enjoy. I'm here today with Agnieszka Joniak-Luti to talk about her new book, The Han, China's Diverse Majority. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Agnieszka, and thanks very, very much for both giving us a book that's so thoughtful and relevant to so many different disciplines, and also for generously making time to talk with me about it today. I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. It's my pleasure.
Of course. So, Agnieszka, let's start, as is traditional for the channel, by talking a little bit about how you came to the field. What brought you to China, and what brought you to that as an academic field?
Well, I'm coming from regional studies in the German speaking or German academia influenced area. It's called Sinology. So my master was in Sinology, and after my master's, I shifted a little bit in terms of disciplines and moved to social anthropology. So I'm coming from regional studies. I have this regional studies background, but then I felt like I need more in terms of methodology. And so during my PhD, I shifted in the direction of social anthropology. And so the book is a kind of combination of my regional studies background and then the theories and methodologies that I acquired while getting into social anthropology. And then China, how did I come to China? I don't even know anymore, but I think it was the fascination with the script, with characters. When I was a teenager, I was fascinated by the different scripts that you have in the world. And I remember I was drawing those different scripts. And then I definitely knew I would study something related to languages, but then studying French or English or Russian, it all seemed a bit too normal. And so I was looking through the catalog of the study catalog at my university in Poznan, and there was Sinology or China studies, and I thought that sounds quite interesting. And I was lucky because it was only every other year that Sinology was offered by the university, and it was precisely in that year that I graduated from my college that it was there. And so I took the examinations, and it was just a bingo, really. So this is how I came to China studies.
Great. Thank you so much. So the introduction of the book talks a little bit about the overall scope and nature of the book. And it mentions that you launched the study with a number of questions in mind. Mm-hmm. And I'll name some of these questions and then ask another question of you. What mm-hmm. does being Han mean to those classified as Hanzu? What are the narratives of Han-ness today? What other collective identities matter to the Hanzu? What are their roles and meanings? How do they relate to one another and to Minzu identity? In what analytical terms can we grasp Minzu and other identity categories predominantly related to home and place? Are they ethnic? Is the Han Minzu an ethnic group? And finally, how can Hanzu seem so united in their Hanness and at the same time be so fragmented and divided? And so as listeners can hopefully gather from this list of questions, This is a book about Han, about Hanness, about identity, and about a kind of constellation of issues and questions and concepts that emerge from the kinds of issues and questions that I just mentioned. So Agnieszka, how did you come to this particular topic? What brought you to this focus for the book?
I think it was as the choice of my studies. It was a little bit accidental, but there were some reasons too. And I started to be interested in this topic in the late 1990s. I started actually in ethnic minority studies, but there were so many excellent scholars working in minority studies in the late 1990s in China, especially in the southwestern China, where I also did my fieldwork for the masters, that I felt like I can't really contribute at that point of my career. Then I wasn't really able to contribute anything substantial to the field of ethnic minority studies anymore. And so I was thinking about what would be the possible area where I could say something and where not so much has been done yet. And then it occurred to me that perhaps focusing on the Han would be the right way to go. And already during my master's, during the fieldwork for my master, which was set in a multi-ethnic village at the Yunnan-Sichuan border, I got interested in the Han living in the village and how they negotiate their Hanness and their majority status in the village where they actually constituted a minority. And so I started from there. I think it's also mentioned in the book that actually this first fieldwork in Zhuozhou in southwest China pointed me a bit in the direction of, perhaps Han studies, would this be something? And then I decided to continue to follow on that in my dissertation and leave Western China, Southwestern China for a while and move to Eastern China to do the field work. So for the first time in my life, I conducted it for the last time. I conducted field work in such a urban context like Beijing and Shanghai metropolises, huge cities where methodologically you have to use very different tools than when you conduct research in a small village or in a small town like I did later. So there was a lot that was new about this new topic and about this new research for me. First of all, methodology. I had to shift from participant observation, which was very important to my previous field work in Southwest China, to a methodology based mainly on semi-structured interviews. And then also the topic, from the focus on ethnic minorities to the focus on the Han majority. And I think it was a great decision because at the same time, a couple of other scholars started to launch something that is called today critical Han studies. So I think it's a rising field, and there are some very interesting people working on issues that relate to my book. So I think it was a good decision to shift from Southwest to the East for this project.
Great. Now, in the introduction, you talk a little bit about your methodology, and you mention the fieldwork in Zhuozhou, and you mention the semi-structured interviews in Beijing and Shanghai in 2002 and 2003, I think.
I think so.
Now, one of the really fascinating things, at least for me, that you talk about when talking about this methodology is you talk about a method whereby you jointly wrote down answers to your questions during these semi-structured interviews. And it sounds like that was actually a really important component of this methodology. So can you talk a little bit about that for us?
I think it's very important to, or this is what I thought back then already, that it's very important to that people you talk to see what you write down. I thought this would establish, how can you put it? I was thinking that I should establish a link between us, like something that we would work together on with my research participants. And so this paper that was lying between us, it was this link on which we worked together. So I was writing in Chinese and then they saw me writing and they were like, oh, no, 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 no. It's not exactly what I meant. We should perhaps write it differently. And so the paper at the end, this 4 or 5 pages that we had or 6, it was really a joint project. And I thought it's very important. It was for me very important to make it such a joint thing, not me coming and taking the words from people and hiding them and taking them with me to Europe to publish them in a form of a book, but to create a framework where we could work together on this, on what is being written down, and negotiate what is being written down. And then I found ethically it was more honest than making notes that my informants would never see. And so, yes, I thought it was crucial to my methodology because, yeah, it created this open situation between me and my research partners.
Great. Now, speaking of taking notes and this kind of collaborative storytelling that it sounds like was part of the process brings us really nicely into the focus of the first chapter. Now, in the first chapter of the book, you talk about the Han as a historically contingent narration. So this mm-hmm. idea of the Han as narration is really important here. Can you talk about that for us?
Yes, this is one of the, I would say, major contributions of this book. I argue that every historical period created own ideas of Hanness, and it also meant something different it meant something different to be Han in these different historical periods. And also, of course, who belonged to the category, who was excluded. It also differed significantly from one historical period to the next. So what I argue is that we have to pay attention to this. Otherwise, something that is practiced very much in Chinese way of reading the Han, namely this kind of teleological evolutionary way of seeing how the Han category came into being, will come in place. And I think this should be avoided because the Han are really a historically contingent category, and so we have to see them. We have to see this Han in different historical periods more like. We have to see them more synchronically than really evolutionary or diachronically. Mm-hmm. This is what I wanted to say by focusing on this historical contingency of the Han. And I also wanted to emphasize that it's not that the meaning is invented by some external agencies. It's the Han themselves who create the meaning of what Hanness is. And so that's why I relate to Benedict Anderson's idea of imagined community, because the Han were imagined in very different ways in different historical periods. So we must pay attention to these different imageries and also to the meanings ascribed and to who was included and excluded in order to see Han not as a this kind of theologically produced category, but really as a series of moments.
Great. Now, you talk here in this chapter about some of the important differences between pre-modern and modern modes of Han narration. In the pre-modern mode of Han narration, this, like the modern mode, is characterized by what you call concurrent coherence and fragmentation. And this mm-hmm. idea that there's at the same time coherence and fragmentation is a theme that we're going to see thread through the entire mm-hmm. book. So it's really important. Now, in this pre-modern mode of narration, you talk about the importance of Confucianism-influenced imagery, the importance of family names, of cultural and ritual markers. And in the modern mode of narration, there's a shift from this kind of culturalism that characterized the pre-modern mode to more of a racialized nationalism. Now, you locate the second half of the 19th century as a really critical point in this transformation of Hanness. So can you talk about that? Why is the second half of the 19th century a critical point? What's going on there that for you is important for us to understand? And what's for you some of the most important aspects of this transformation that moves us from pre-modern to modern?
Yes, I think there were a couple of very important processes taking place. One was this genealogization of Manchu identity, which was closely linked to how Hanness started to be articulated in this period more in racial terms, more in nationalist terms, as a community linked to a specific guo or a country. This was one thing. And then, of course, there were other important processes like the disintegration of the imperial power, the rise of nationalism, the rise of evolutionism inspired by literature from the West. And so there were a couple of very important processes that changed completely the thinking of what the Han is, what's the role of this category, what's the meaning of this category, what function it should play in something like a state, a modern, emerging modern state. So there was the shift from imperial power to the notion of state as having boundaries. And so this all affected the way Hanness was formulated, what attributes it had, and the role that it was expected to play. While during the I'm talking about Ming and Qing in my book, predominantly about this part of the imperial period, the role that the Han played in the imperial times was very different from the one that Sun Yat-sen envisaged for the Han to play in the future Chinese state. So Hanness had to be reformulated in order to be able to carry these new ideas of nation and state and China as a state in a community, in an international community of nation states.
That's right. And the book actually, in this chapter in particular, pays really interesting attention to the work of nationalist interests in the words of the book, creating the notion of the Han as a racial community to mobilize its resources against foreign invaders. And the chapter it's really clear here. And the chapter traces what happens under communist rule in the sense that it kind of further strengthens, as you put it here in the book, this genealogical mentality, right? And this link between kinship and nation. So it's really interesting here for all kinds of reasons. Now, as we move from the first chapter to the second chapter, we move into a chapter that looks at the contemporary. And chapter two focuses on contemporary narratives of Hanness. Now, there are so many interesting things happening in this chapter. I would love to talk with you, honestly, for the rest of our time just about this chapter, but we won't. So in the meantime, for you, you talk about some of the most important markers of Hanness that emerge out of your interviews. And there's this really helpful table as well on 48 to 50 or pages, 48 to 50 for listeners. For you, what are some of the most important markers of Hanness that came out of these interviews?
Well, there are a couple which I thought were very interesting. Something that sounds really innocent is the first one, for instance, that the Han are the largest population and have the widest distribution. It's such a powerful statement, which I think discuss also later, that it really positions the Han as the Minzu of China. So it represents them as omnipresent and as the largest population and the and people who are who live everywhere all over China. So it has this kind of inclusive character. And then the second one that I'm looking at, Han do not have any characteristic or symbols characteristics or symbols. This was mentioned very often by my interviewees, who thought that Han are just normal and they do things in ordinary way. There is nothing special about the Han. I thought this was also... This is also crucial to the understanding of the role of the Han category in China. It is very much this kind of invisible category, like maleness and whiteness in the West, as feminists and racial studies have shown. In China, it's the Han who are invisible, as I think it's Stephen Harrell who says it, that the Han are really invisible in their dastness. They seem to be just there. Without any specific things about them. And of course, I don't want to say it's an advantage, but it shows that they are really the standard. But on the other hand, it is also a problem of the Han identity, which my interviewees articulated and also other scholars in the field of critical Han studies articulate, that Hanness appears to be in many situations to the Han themselves really a little bit an empty identity. There is nothing like ethnic minorities. With ethnic minorities that you can show, oh, they have a specific dress and they have these dances and they have this special food. You really don't. It's difficult to find these things about Han. So this also contributes a little bit to the this kind of emptiness. I don't really like to use this word because it's not exactly this, but yeah, there is a certain emptiness to this category that. For instance, the movement like the Han clothing that we observe in China since the late 2000s, I think, it tries to attribute some characteristics to the Han. So it invents a specific Han clothing for the Han, so that they also have their specific characteristics like the minorities do. Yeah, so I could comment like this on many of those markers. They are just, I thought they were extremely interesting. It was extremely interesting. And for me, during my research, it was important to assume the perspective of my informants. This is perhaps also why how the book differs from others in the field of critical Han studies, that it really does not base on historical materials or on statistics or on anything like that, but it bases on the semi-structured interviews and assumes the perspective of my research informants. So I always start from what they are saying and to what they see. And from there, I try to look how it relates to larger political, social, or historical processes.
That's right. And this chapter is really, really rich, right? I mean, like I said, we can talk, talk about any of these markers. But there's some important kind of central points that the chapter is making that I just kind of want to mark before asking you to talk about one of them. So mark, no pun intended, because we're talking about markers. So you talk about kind of the largest category that constructs the Han in various ways as better than minorities, right? You've already talked about numerical superiority, this idea of a long history, cultural dominance, and a kind of character that is, as you put it here in the book, hardworking, responsible, modern, and patriotic. There's also kind of a shift, an important shift, again, to kind of locate us in this move from the pre-modern to the modern, or from the imperial to the national. You talk about the importance of certain kinds of markers in imperial China, rituals, patriarchal family structure, family names, descent, agrarian occupations. And there's actually a shift that you're identifying with that, or that accompanied the rise of nationalism at the 20th century. We see a shift to markers that coalesce around ideas of shared national descent, common ancestors, linear national history and national language, and a political bond between Han Minzu and the Chinese state. And this is really, really clear in the book. And you tell us here that this signals a shift from imperial culturalism to a nationalist symbolic order. Okay, so this is really interesting, but listeners and readers might wonder, how do these narratives get distributed, right? How do people learn to think and talk in these terms? Like, what makes these markers move, and how do these markers permeate into a particular context? And you talk about two related, really, really important ways that happens: education and language. This is really important, and this is one of the ways that the book speaks to, I think, a wide range of disciplinary contexts, even beyond Chinese studies, right, and beyond contemporary mm-hmm. understandings of China, including studies of linguistics and studies of education. So mm-hmm. can you talk for us about education and language? For you, what are some of the most important ways that education and language are shaping the movement and the concretization of these markers?
Yes, of course. This was the question that I was asking myself when being in Shanghai and Beijing, conducting my interview. And I realized that some of the narratives and statements that my informants made, they were identical to those that I collected in this village of Duosuo in southern China, in southwest China. How many years? 5 years earlier. And so this made me think, what is it that that distributes these narratives, even in exact wording, throughout China? And I thought education is probably really crucial, because at the time when I conducted my village, fieldwork in southwest China, in this village, there was no TV or no radio in the village. There was no electricity. So it was the mass media which distributed these images and the statements around there. Mm-hmm. And so I thought it probably is education. Interestingly, as I think I also write in the book, especially children who attended the Chinese language middle school were really full of those kind of this kind of evolutionary ideas that Han are more advanced than the minorities, that Han are more clever than the minorities, that Han have the they formulated powerful culture compared to minorities, and that they were more skilled in technical jobs than minorities, and so on. So I thought education is crucial. And so here we come to a very big problem or a very big issue now in the study, in minority studies, namely the shift to bilingual or even Chinese, totally Chinese language education in minority areas. This is, of course, in this sense, it's not only education, it's also the Han language or the Chinese language through which these narratives become distributed. And so if we shift from Naro, Yi, Uyghur, Tibetan education to the Chinese language education, then the narratives or the power that distributes the narratives becomes even stronger. I don't really know how to formulate it, but it's not then only education, it's also the Chinese language that contributes to the even greater influence of this kind of evolutionary and Confucianism, because there are different philosophical orders that play into this kind of stratification. So these things get distributed through Han Chinese education even faster or even more efficiently than through the minority language education, where vocabulary is not—it's not the same. This kind of power inequalities, which are inscribed in Chinese language, in terminology that describes the relations between the Han majority and the minorities, is absent in the languages used by the ethnic minorities, mm-hmm. of course. So yeah, these I think are the two major tools. Of course, now because mass media is becoming more and more popular even in ethnic minority areas in the West, in Tibetan areas and in Xinjiang, mass media is currently also perhaps the third force that distributes this kind of unequal imageries throughout China.
That's right. Language education in a lot of ways it can be an ideological education, right? An ethical education, mm-hmm. and all kinds of things can be mm-hmm. transmitted. I'm right now working on a book chapter on an 18th century language textbook for bannermen who were learning how to speak mm-hmm. Manchu, and just, you know, looking at the way language textbooks convey all kinds of things that we don't necessarily think about, right? That limited to mm-hmm. language. I think you're making a really important point here. So as we move from this chapter to the third chapter, moving right along, we move to a chapter that you call Topographies of Identity. This is also really fascinating, and it gets us to one of the most important concepts and arguments of the book, or one of a number of them. So in the words of the book, you make a point here, in a situationally dependent way, Han individuals switch between a number of collective identities, including minzu and nation, but also, commonly, place-related identities. And that's the words of the book. And this chapter really explores that. It focuses on, in particular, the importance of what you call here home place identities. So let's talk about that. Agnieszka, can you talk about for you what is this notion of a home place identity? Why is it important, and how is home defined for your participants here?
Yes, this is of course a fascinating question for me. This the notion of home was crucial to my research. First of all, of course, I came with this. If you come from China studies, you have the notion of home place or 家乡故乡 as a stable thing. Then you start talking to your research partners or research participants, and they tell you, oh, my home place is here, and then the second home place is there. And then because I have studied in Beijing for 4 years, it's actually also a home place for me now. And so I realized home place is crucial to how Han identify themselves and identify other Han. But the notion of home place is extremely unstable. It's mobile. The people have so many home places right now. And so some people would say, because I was born in Hunan, so Hunan is my home place. Others, and this is the only home place that I have. And others will say, the great majority of my interviewees, they would say, yes, I have one ancestral home place, and then I have my birthplace, which is also in a way my home place, and then there is the place where I study, and this is my third home place, and I'm going to marry a person from Shandong, and this is going to be my home place now. So what I realized, what was crucial, is that home place is really an unstable concept, and one has to recognize it, because it has great importance to how we think about this kind of attachment to place, attachment to soil in contemporary China. People can't talk constantly about it, but if we don't pay attention to the actual instability of the concept, we might get a very different understanding of what it is that they actually talk about.
One of the things that the chapter really highlights, and I just want to again mark this because it seems particularly important, it highlights the agency of Han individuals. In the words of the book, you talk about this in terms of their selecting, assuming, swapping, or rejecting these various kinds of home place identities. So can you speak briefly to this issue of agency? For you, what's important for us to understand about that?
Yes, I think what is crucial is to understand that places have different value in China. So there is a whole hierarchy of places. And if you come from the socially or a place that stands high on the social hierarchy, you profit in many ways in your social interactions. You make profit. And if you come from those places that are low on this hierarchy, you are disadvantaged and discriminated. So in my research, what the places that clearly occurred as the source of discrimination were Henan, Subei, Inner Mongolia, and Sichuan. So people coming from these regions and provinces, they often try to hide their home place identity and instead assume another home place identity that would be more convenient, perhaps, in social interactions. And so for instance, people from Henan would assume an identity of Shandong people because this would facilitate many things for them, for instance, when they moved to Beijing. So people said that it was, for instance, easier for them to find an apartment or a place to live. Perhaps apartment is exaggerated. A place to live when they said they were from Shandong, then if they were honest about their home place, and would say that they were from Henan. So there is this whole hierarchy of home places in China, discrimination related to it, and the life of especially people who are on the move is really determined by their home place, which of course pushes them to manipulate a little bit this area, these different identities, assume identities that are more convenient, which increase the chances, for instance, on the marital market or on the job market. So this is a fascinating film that follows from what I said, that home place really became, perhaps not even became, it has always perhaps been a really unstable concept.
Mm-hmm. Now, the next chapter really explores this in interesting ways that I think engage with some of what you've just talked about. Mm-hmm. Chapter 4 looks at important socionyms or collective identity labels and stereotypes that your informants used to both identify themselves and to identify others. Now, the analysis here identifies 5 major differentiation paradigms, as you call it, them in the book, mm-hmm. among contemporary Hanzu. And some of them you've actually kind of already talked a little bit about, even implicitly. The first major paradigm really speaks to what you were just talking about. Han individuals think of themselves and other Han in terms of regional differentiation. And there's this table which lists a whole bunch of examples of how people talked about people from different places that include, but are not limited to, 9-head birds of Hubei, burly fellows from Shandong. We've got potato heads. We've got little bosses. We've got big mouths and hicks and bumpkins. I mean, and that does not exhaust all the possibilities. So it's a really interesting archive, actually, of socionyms here. There are also differentiation paradigms between urbanity and rurality, mm-hmm. so the urban and the rural, between locals and outsiders or natives and strangers, between mainlanders and Hong Kongese or Taiwanese, and interestingly, and I want to ask you to talk a little bit about this, between the Hakka and all other Han. So mm-hmm. you incorporate this last or this fifth paradigm and then tell us that it's not very common, but it seems important here. So can you talk about that a little bit and what you take to be the most important of this? And really, if you want to talk about what you think is most important about the other paradigms too, feel free.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, unfortunately, among my research participants, there were not that many Hakka. That's why I think it's only, it's only 4 people who mentioned that Hakka are just different from any other Han. So I can't really talk that much about it. But the other paradigms they are also spatial. Like before a while, I was talking about home place identities, but place actually also in other ways, different spatial identities seem to be crucial to how Han categorize and identify themselves and other Han. Home place is one way to differentiate between oneself and the others. But as you said, there is also the differentiation between a very important one between locals or natives and then outsiders and migrants. This is a very discriminatory differentiation, and it's extremely powerful. So especially in such cities like Beijing and Shanghai, you will find the people who say, we are from here, and everybody else is migrant, is stranger, is worse than we are. So this is a way to exclude, to kind of protect the resources, protect the identity of Beijing Ren and Shanghai Ren from becoming it too broad, from becoming inclusive, too inclusive. People who see themselves as natives of Beijing and Shanghai try to build boundaries around this identity to exclude everybody else, and in this way to protect their home place, the high standing of this home place at this social hierarchies of the Han. And then another very clear differentiation also related to place is this rural-urban differentiation, which is also very discriminatory, like the urban like the local outsider one. Mm-hmm. And here the socionyms and the stereotypes collected, which I collected, are really unpleasant. This is these two boundaries between urbanites and ruralites and between locals and strangers. These two boundaries, around these two boundaries, the socionyms and stereotypes that I collected were really the most discriminatory and unpleasant. The other differentiation in according to home places, for instance, or this distinction between mainlanders or Han in mainland China and then Taiwanese and Hong Kongese, were more equal, I would say. The difference was observed, or it was registered that there is a difference, but they were not that obviously discriminatory.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you so much. Before we move on to the next chapter, mm-hmm. I'll just kind of, there was a moment in this chapter that I really liked that I think is at the same time, it should be self-evident, but it's a really important point to make because it's not always self-evident and it's got much broader relevance than simply the case study that you're talking about here, although it also pertains to that, obviously. You say mm-hmm. the North needs the South to become the North. Etc. Mm-hmm. Right? The self needs the other to become the self, basically. And I just want to mark that again, because I think it's a really important point here. And it's got potentially much broader relevance, right? These categories mutually constitute each other.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. On both sides. So as we move to chapter 5, this is the last body chapter before the epilogue. And this is a chapter that returns us to the theme of fragmentation. You say here in this chapter that the fragmentation of the Hanzu is substantial and permeating. Mm-hmm. So in order to start to get at that, you tell us that every interview that you did was concluded with three questions. And I'll name those questions, then ask you to talk a little bit more mm-hmm. about one of them. First question, do Hanzu all over the country share the same culture? Second question, are all Hanzu inherently alike? Third question, do all people classified as Hanzu have enough in common to form one Minzu? Okay, so this last one is really interesting here for all kinds of reasons. You tell us that overwhelmingly, the answer to this last question, do all people classified as Hanzu have enough in common to form one Minzu? Overwhelmingly, respondents answered yes. Okay, can you talk about that? What's important about that? And what does this mean? Like, what are the stakes of this for how we understand mm-hmm. what a Minzu is and how it relates to conceptions upon this?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I ask these three questions always at the end of the interviews. And I thought it was very interesting how the people I talked to, they admitted, yes, Han are diversified in terms of culture, yes. And they didn't have any problems to talk about this kind of diversity or diversity in terms of home places, or to say that urban Han and rural Han are different, or that migrants and locals are so different. But then when I asked about the Minzu, then the atmosphere changed. And you could see that there is a lot at stake. People became aware that politics came into the conversation at this point, and they immediately assumed this kind of attitude, safe attitude, and say, oh no, we are at the end all one Minzu. So regional differences, all these other differences that we talked about before, they are really secondary. What matters is that we are all Han. And so for me, this was fascinating to see this turn from after 2 or 3 hours of talking about all these differences and fragmentation and then hierarchization of these identities and discrimination too, and all these power struggles between different regional groups and or Han urbanites and ruralites, suddenly there was this step back and saying, no, we are actually, after all, we are all Han. And so in this moment, I think that the state stepped into our conversations and people returned behind the safe, you know, wall or curtain. And they said it's all this differentiation or fragmentation is actually secondary. I don't think so, but this is how they formulated it. And of course, it's an important statement in terms of seeing the role of the state in identity choices and seeing how it influences identity negotiations and how it plays into how people formulate their attachments. What I rather think is that in Eastern China, Hanness is really unable to mediate all these social exclusions and the fragmentation, but this doesn't matter. What matters is that my research participants felt that when that you have to, or that, that there is this important element that you can't forget, which is the state. And the state also has a saying in what we are talking about here. So yeah, it was a surprise to me, kind of, because I thought when we talked for so long about these different exclusions and discriminations, people would reflect more about it, about this last question, but it was not the case. The answers came very fast that we are all one.
Now let's, this actually brings us to one of the big questions, right? I mean, like, we're at almost the end of the interview, but we're coming to one of the questions that's one of the huge consequential questions here. And here it is. Are Han, Minzu, and other non-Minzu identity categories to which Han are expressing attachment, in the words of the book, ethnic? Mm-hmm. Are these ethnic? And why does it matter one way or another? Can you speak to that?
I think it matters because it would have a potential to contribute something new to the studies of ethnicity. And this is, so far, ethnicity, this concept, and methods relate or methodologies related to this concept have been used to discuss rather smaller groups. Here we have the Han, a population of 1.3 billion people. So in my opinion, thinking about how far is the concept of ethnicity useful to grasp this kind of situation? It has a potential to expand the notion of ethnicity or to further discuss the notion of ethnicity in general. So this chapter, this last chapter, is really meant more as a contribution to ethnicity studies than to Han studies, actually. And there I propose two concepts, which are transitory ethnicity, and the second one was what degree of ethnicity, I think. And so I propose that we can perhaps talk of degree of ethnicity. So some identities might be more ethnic than others. And I propose this concept in order to save a little bit the concept of ethnicity, which has become so omnipresent recently. I try to establish some kind of boundaries around this concept so that it remains useful, because I think it can be useful in the analysis. Like the ethnicity, this kind of identification and boundary making process is different from other identification and boundary making processes. And so what I try to do is establish a little bit boundaries around the concept of ethnicity, and instead of using it everywhere for all sorts of different identifications or identity processes, I try to show that there is something specific about ethnicity, that it's not all identity processes are ethnicity, that ethnicity has something specific to itself, like the belief in common descent, history, shared culture, ancestors, and then this sense of common destiny, and the continuity, sense of continuity in time, both imagined and actual. So I say there is something specific about ethnicity that we should try to keep, but we should not try to make the concept too stiff. And that's why I propose to talk about the degree of ethnicity. So for me, the Han Minzu or Hanzu in relation to other Minzu in China are more ethnic than, for instance, home place identities when they relate to other home place identities. And then the other concept of transient ethnicity, which I propose, is to show that ethnicity is something situational. So an identity can be ethnic at one time and then at another time not, because as you mentioned earlier, Han individuals switch between different identities depending on the context. Sometimes they would emphasize a home place identity at another time, an urban identity at yet another time, perhaps a mainlander identity or a Han Minzu identity. And so depending on the context and on the other that they face, they activate different identities. And in this moment of activation, very different identities can transiently become ethnic for organizational and reasons and for the purpose of identification.
Great. Thank you so much. Now, there's also an epilogue to the book that returns us to some of the most important interventions that the book is making into critical Han studies. And you've already talked about, actually, I think one of the important ones, which is that the book, as you mentioned before, is not taking a kind of historical approach to these issues, but is basing it on interviews, right? It's looking at the kind of mm-hmm. politics and the contemporary practice of this kind of identity. Are there any other ways that we haven't talked about that you feel it's important to mention in terms of the way the book is contributing to this small but growing field of critical Han studies?
I'm not sure, but I think perhaps it would be important to mention that social anthropology has really a potential to bring something new into critical Han studies. There is this problem, let's say, with how to study the Han. And of course, history is a very good tool to do it. But social anthropology offers these kind of interesting methodologies that would have the potential to expand critical Han studies in a different direction. Social anthropology brings this kind of reflection on positionality of the researcher and reflection on what kind of knowledge we generate by our questions and how we analyze this, what we collect, the research material that we collect. I think this would be an important input to the critical Han studies, where social anthropology is still, kind of still a marginal discipline. So I would wish more social anthropologists engaging with the Han category, which is, of course, intimidating. It's a huge methodological problem, how to tackle this category. But I think we shouldn't be too afraid. We should just do it and then see what problems arise, what methodological issues arise. How can we link these different studies of localized communities with those who talk of broader processes? I think social anthropology could really offer a new interesting perspective on Han studies.
Great. So Agnieszka, we're now at the conclusion of our interview, but of course there's mm-hmm. a lot of material in the book that we haven't had a chance to talk about. Is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners before we wrap up?
I actually don't think so.
Okay, great.
I'm looking through my notes, but I think we have talked more or less about everything that I noted out as important about intra-Han hierarchies and the different distinctions, and that Hanness is a resource because of this specific power relations ingrained in this ethnonym. I think we really went through everything that I noted out. I think yes, thank you.
So now that the book is out, what's next for you? What are you working on now? What are you currently inspired by?
Yes, after this research in Eastern China, in field work in Eastern China, in Beijing and Shanghai, I decided it's time for me to move back to Western China. So my current research project is on Xinjiang. It's actually already the second project on Xinjiang that I'm doing. This shift occurred, let's say, from Eastern China back to Western China in 2010. And I focus on two things. One thing is Han migration to Xinjiang. I'm very interested in, so this is actually a continuation of critical Han studies. So I'm interested in why Han migrate to Xinjiang, what their motivations are, how they adapt to the region, what kind of identities emerge after some decades of living there. You have this very interesting Xinjiang Ren, Xinjiang person identity emerging now. I'm also very interested in how Han establish themselves in the region. There are this, how they claim the place for themselves, a place which is, which until some decades ago had almost no Han living there. So this is one part of the project. And then the other thing it's going, the other part of the project is going in the direction of the anthropology of infrastructure. So I'm very much interested in the roads, road construction, roads maintenance, what roads do with the with space along them, what roads do with people who live along them, how people interact with infrastructures, what road, what kind of influence roads have on spatial production, in on what role they play in processes of territory. Yes, this kind of research questions I'm working on now.
Great. Well, best of luck with that research.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks for taking time out of that to talk with me today. It's really
Oh, it was a pleasure for me. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Congratulations on the book. You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.